Chapter 5 of the Benson Murder Case by S.S. Van Dyne. This Legamus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for non-commercial purposes, as long as Legamus is credited, and any new creation is licensed under the same terms. Read by Kathy Barrett. Chapter 5. Gathering Information. Saturday, June 15, forenoon. You will remember the sensation caused by Alvin Benson's murder. It was one of those crimes that appeal irresistibly to the popular imagination. Mystery is the basis of all romance, and about the Benson case there hung an impenetrable aura of mystery. It was many days before any definite light was shed on the circumstances surrounding the shooting, but numerous ignis fatui arose to beguile the public's imagination, and wild speculations were heard on all sides. Alvin Benson, while not a romantic figure in any respect, had been well known, and his personality had been a colourful and spectacular one. He had been a member of New York's wealthy bohemian social set, an avid sportsman, a rash gambler, and professional man about town. And his life, led on the borderland of the demi-monde, had contained many highlights. His exploits in the nightclubs and cabarets had long supplied the subject matter for exaggerated stories and comments in the various local papers and magazines which batten on Broadway's scandalmongers. Benson and his brother, Anthony, had at the time of the former's sudden death been running a brokerage office at 21 Wall Street, under the name of Benson and Benson. Both were regarded by the other brokers of the street as shrewd businessmen, though perhaps a shade unethical when gauged by the constitution and bylaws of the New York Stock Exchange. They were markedly contrasted as to temperament and taste, and saw little of each other outside the office. Alvin Benson devoted his entire leisure to pleasure-seeking, and was a regular patron of the city's leading cafés, whereas Anthony Benson, who was the older and had served as a major in the late war, followed a sedate and conventional existence, spending most of his evenings quietly at his clubs. Both, however, were popular in their respective circles, and between them they had built up a large clientele. The glamour of the financial district had much to do with the manner in which the crime was handled by the newspapers. Moreover, the murder had been committed at a time when the metropolitan press was experiencing a temporary lull in sensationalism, and the story was spread over the front pages of the papers with a prodigality rarely encountered in such cases. Even the famous Elwell case, which came several years later and bore certain points of similarity to the Benson case, created no greater sensation, despite the fact that Elwell was more widely known than Benson, and the persons involved were more prominent socially. Indeed, the Benson case was referred to several times in descriptions of the Elwell case, and one anti-administration paper regretted editorially that John F. X. Markham was no longer district attorney of New York. Eminent detectives throughout the country were interviewed by enterprising reporters. Histories of famous unsolved murder cases were revived, and clairvoyants and astrologers were engaged by the Sunday editors to solve the mystery by various metaphysical devices. Photographs and detailed diagrams were the daily accompaniments of these journalistic outpourings. In all the news stories, the grey Cadillac and the pearl-handled Smith & Wesson were featured. There were pictures of Cadillac cars, touched up and reconstructed to accord with Patrolman McLaughlin's description, some of them even showing the fishing tackle protruding from the tonneau. A photograph of Benson's center table had been taken, with the secret drawer enlarged and reproduced in an inset. One Sunday magazine went so far as to hire an expert cabinet-maker to write a dissertation on secret compartments in furniture. The Benson case, from the outset, had proved a trying and difficult one from the police standpoint. Within an hour of the time that Vance and I had left the scene of the crime, a systematic investigation had been launched by the men of the Homicide Bureau in charge of Sergeant Heath. Benson's house was again gone over thoroughly, and all his private correspondence read. But nothing was brought forth that could throw any light on the tragedy. No weapon was found, aside from Benson's own Smith & Wesson, and though all the window grills were again inspected, they were found to be secure, indicating that the murderer had either let himself in with a key or else been admitted by Benson. Heath, by the way, was unwilling to admit this latter possibility, despite Mrs. Platts's positive assertion that no other person besides herself and Benson had a key. Because of the absence of any definite clue, other than the handbag and the gloves, the only proceeding possible was the interrogating of Benson's friends and associates in the hope of uncovering some fact which would furnish a trail. It was by this process, also, that Heath hoped to establish the identity of the owner of the handbag. A special effort was therefore made to ascertain where Benson had spent the evening. But though many of his acquaintances were questioned, and the cafés where he habitually dined were visited, no one could at once be found who had seen him that night. Nor, as far as it was possible to learn, had he mentioned to anyone his plans for the evening. Furthermore, no general information of a helpful nature came to light immediately, although the police pushed their inquiry with the utmost thoroughness. Benson apparently had no enemies. He had not quarrelled seriously with anyone, and his affairs were reported in their usual orderly shape. Major Anthony Benson was naturally the principal person looked to for information, because of his intimate knowledge of his brother's affairs. And it was in this connection that the district attorney's office did its chief functioning at the beginning of the case. Markham had lunched with Major Benson the day the crime was discovered, and though the latter had shown a willingness to cooperate, even to the detriment of his brother's character, his suggestions were of little value. He explained to Markham that, though he knew most of his brother's associates, he could not name anyone who would have any reason for committing such a crime, or anyone who, in his opinion, would be able to help in leading the police to the guilty person. He admitted frankly, however, that there was a side to his brother's life with which he was unacquainted, and regretted that he was unable to suggest any specific way of ascertaining the hidden facts. But he intimated that his brother's relations with women were of a somewhat unconventional nature, and he ventured the opinion that there was a bare possibility of a motive being found in that direction. Pursuant of the few indefinite and unsatisfactory suggestions of Major Benson, Markham had immediately put to work two good men from the detective division assigned to the district attorney's office, with instructions to confine their investigations to Benson's women acquaintances so as not to appear in any way to be encroaching upon the activities of the central office men. Also, as a result of Vance's apparent interest in the housekeeper at the time of the interrogation, he had sent a man to look into the woman's antecedents and relationships. Mrs. Platts, it was learned, had been born in a small Pennsylvania town of German parents, both of whom were dead, and had been a widow for over 16 years. Before coming to Benson, she had been with one family for 12 years, and had left the position only because her mistress had given up housekeeping and moved into a hotel. Her former employer, when questioned, said she thought there had been a daughter but had never seen the child, and knew nothing of it. In these facts there was nothing to take hold of, and Markham had merely filed the report as a matter of form. Heath had instigated a city-wide search for the grey Cadillac, although he had little faith in its direct connection with the crime. And in this the newspapers helped considerably by the extensive advertising given the car. One curious fact developed that fired the police with the hope that the Cadillac might indeed hold some clue to the mystery. A street cleaner, having read or heard about the fishing tackle in the machine, reported the finding of two jointed fishing rods, in good condition, at the side of one of the drives in Central Park near Columbus Circle. The question was, were these rods part of the equipment Patrolman McLaughlin had seen in the Cadillac? The owner of the car might conceivably have thrown them away in his flight, but on the other hand, they might have been lost by someone else while driving through the park. No further information was forthcoming, and on the morning of the day following the discovery of the crime, the case, so far as any definite progress toward a solution was concerned, had taken no perceptible forward step. That morning Vance had sent Curry out to buy him every available newspaper, and he had spent over an hour perusing the various accounts of the crime. It was unusual for him to glance at a newspaper, even casually, and I could not refrain from expressing my amazement at his sudden interest in a subject so entirely outside his normal routine. "No, Van, old dear," he explained languidly, "I am not becoming sentimental, or even human, as that word is erroneously used to-day. I cannot say with Terence, 'Homo sum, humani nihil, ami alienum puto,' because I regard most things that are called human as decidedly alien to myself. But, you know, this little flurry in crime has proved rather interestin', or, as the magazine writers say, intriguing. Beastly word. Van, you really should read this precious interview with Sergeant Heath. He takes an entire column to say, 'I know nothing.' A priceless lad. I'm becoming positively fond of him." "It may be," I suggested, "that Heath is keeping his true knowledge from the papers as a bit of tactical diplomacy." "No," Vance returned, with a sad wag of the head. "No man has so little vanity that he would deliberately reveal himself to the world as a creature with no perceptible powers of human reasoning, as he does in all these morning journals, for the mere sake of bringing one murderer to justice. That would be martyrdom gone mad.
Markham, at any rate, may know or suspect something that hasn't been revealed, I said.
Vance pondered a moment.
That's not impossible, he admitted. He has kept himself modestly in the background in all this journalistic palaver. Suppose we look into the matter more thoroughly, eh, what?
Going to the telephone, he called the district attorney's office, and I heard him make an appointment with Markham for lunch at the Stuyvesant Club.
What about that Nadelman statuette at Stieglitz, remembering the reason for my presence at Vance's that morning?
I ain't in the mood for Greek simplifications today, he answered, turning again to his newspapers.
Vance, who had lived many years in England, frequently said ain't, a contraction which is regarded there more leniently than in this country. He also pronounced eight as if it were spelt et, and I cannot remember his ever using the word stomach or bug, both of which are under the social ban in England. To say that I was surprised at his attitude is to express it mildly. In all my association with him, I had never known him to forego his enthusiasm for art in favour of any other divertisement, and heretofore anything pertaining to the law and its operations had failed to interest him. I realized, therefore, that something of an unusual nature was at work in his brain, and I refrained from further comment.
Markham was a little late for the appointment at the club, and Vance and I were already at our favorite corner table when he arrived.
"Well, my good Lycurgus," Vance greeted him, "aside from the fact that several new and significant clues have been unearthed, and that the public may expect important developments in the very near future, and all that sort of tosh, how are things really going?"
Markham smiled. "I see you have been reading the newspapers. What do you think of the accounts?"
"Typical, no doubt," replied Vance. "They carefully and painstakingly omit nothing but the essentials."
"Indeed," Markham's tone was jocular. "And what, may I ask, do you regard as the essentials of the case?"
"In my foolish amateur way," said Vance, "I looked upon dear Alvin's toupee as a rather conspicuous essential, don't you know?"
"Benson, at any rate, regarded it in that light, I imagine. Anything else?"
"Well, there was the collar and the tie on the chiffonnier."
"And," added Markham chafingly, "don't overlook the false teeth in the tumbler."
"You're positively coruscating," Vance exclaimed. "Yes, they too were an essential of the situation, and I'll warrant the incomparable Heath didn't even notice them. But the other Aristotles present were equally sketchy in their observations."
"You weren't particularly impressed by the investigation yesterday, I take it," said Markham.
"On the contrary," Vance assured him, "I was impressed to the point of stupefaction. The whole proceedings constituted a masterpiece of absurdity. Everything relevant was sublimely ignored. There were at least a dozen points de départ, all leading in the same direction, but not one of them apparently was even noticed by any of the officiating pourparlers. Everybody was too busy at such silly occupations as looking for cigarette ends and inspecting the ironwork at the windows. Those grills, by the way, were rather attractive, Florentine design."
Markham was both amused and ruffled.
"One's pretty safe with the police, Vance," he said. "They get there eventually." "I simply adore your trusting nature," murmured Vance. "But confide in me, what do you know regarding Benson's murderer?"
Markham hesitated. "This is, of course, in confidence," he said at length. "But this morning, right after you phoned, one of the men I had put to work on the amatory end of Benson's life reported that he had found the woman who left her handbag and gloves at the house that night. The initials on the handkerchief gave him the clue. And he dug up some interesting facts about her. As I suspected, she was Benson's dinner companion that evening. She's an actress, musical comedy, I believe. Muriel St. Clair by name."
"Most unfortunate," breathed Vance. "I was hoping, you know, your myrmidons wouldn't discover the lady. I haven't the pleasure of her acquaintance, or I'd send her a note of commiseration. Now I presume you'll play the juge d'instruction and chivy her most horribly, what?"
"I shall certainly question her, if that's what you mean." Markham's manner was preoccupied, and during the rest of the lunch we spoke but little. As we sat in the club's lounge room later, having our smoke, Major Benson, who had been standing dejectedly at a window close by, caught sight of Markham and came over to us. He was a full-faced man of about 50, with grave, kindly features and a sturdy, erect body. He greeted Vance and me with a casual bow and turned at once to the district attorney.
"Markham, I've been thinking things over constantly since our lunch yesterday," he said, and there's one other suggestion I think I might make. There's a man named Leander Fife who is very close to Alvin, and it's possible he could give you some helpful information. His name didn't occur to me yesterday, for he doesn't live in the city. He's on Long Island somewhere. Port Washington, I think. It's just an idea. The truth is, I can't seem to figure out anything that makes sense in this terrible affair." He drew a quick, resolute breath, as if to check some involuntary sign of emotion. It was evident that the man, for all his habitual passivity of nature, was deeply moved. "That's a good suggestion, Major," Markham said, making a notation on the back of a letter. "I'll get after it immediately." Vance, who during this brief interchange had been gazing unconcernedly out of the window, turned and addressed himself to the Major. "How about Colonel Ostrander? I've seen him several times in the company of your brother." Major Benson made a slight gesture of depreciation. "Only an acquaintance. He'd be of no value." Then he turned to Markham. "I don't imagine it's time even to hope that you've run across anything." Markham took his cigar from his mouth and, turning it about in his fingers, contemplated it thoughtfully. "I wouldn't say that," he remarked after a moment. "I've managed to find out whom your brother dined with Thursday night, and I know that this person returned home with him shortly after midnight." He paused as if deliberating the wisdom of saying more. Then, "The fact is, I don't need a great deal more evidence than I've got already to go before the grand jury and ask for an indictment." A look of surprised admiration flashed in the Major's sombre face. "Thank God for that, Markham," he said. Then, setting his heavy jaw, he placed his hand on the district attorney's shoulder. "Go the limit, for my sake," he urged. "If you want me for anything, I'll be here at the club till late." With this, he turned and walked from the room. "It seems a bit cold-blooded to bother the Major with questions so soon after his brother's death," commented Markham. "Still, the world has got to go on." Vance stifled a yawn. "Why, in heaven's name?" he murmured listlessly. End of chapter 5.